The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome again to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I've got a bunch of new questions on tap here. I've got Jim stuck in the penthouse recording studio again, and we're ready to go.
It's cold in here.
It's like 70 degrees outside.
I know. Colorado's having a terrible fall, folks. I mean, seriously, I'm not joking. It is hot, warm, and dry, 60s, 70s. People are loving it. I'm hating it. But it's cold in here today upstairs in the, what he calls the penthouse. I call the room leading into the bathroom. But
that's called an ensuite.
Ensuite? So I'm in the ensuite, not the penthouse.
Well, the bathroom's the ensuite.
Oh, the bathroom's
the
ensuite.
The penthouse has an ensuite bathroom. Yeah.
It sounds so lovely. But it's cold.
Nice.
It's cold. I'm just saying it's cold.
It's to keep you alert.
Yeah. All right. That was all I had to say today.
Yeah. We can just dive right into it, I guess.
I guess we could. This is a Q&A show, folks. So we've got the Q's. You have the A's. I mean, the other way around. They have the A's. We have the Q's. No. You have questions, we have answers. I would stick to that.
Well, it's starting off smooth.
It is smooth. You can tell that this is... I keep telling people we do not rehearse, we do not do any takes, we just record. I think long-time listeners know we're totally serious on that now. New people might be wondering, what the hell are we listening to this
show for? Why aren't you doing this over again?
Yeah, exactly. Why aren't you starting over
again?
We got
no time for that.
Sadly, that is true. We don't have the time for that. It is Friday afternoon, 2 o'clock. We're getting ready to wrap up our week. I still have a few more things I have to work on after we record before heading home for the weekend. And hopefully well, when do they listen to this?
Saturday.
Oh, wow, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I hope everyone, as you listen to this, is having a good weekend. Mm-hmm. I hope to be having a good weekend. It's going to be 60-something, so I'm going to be working in my garden. I'm making it bigger. I don't know why I'm making the damn thing bigger. I think they're going to have watering restrictions. Well, you know me. I'm just weird. So, yeah, I'm making it bigger. But that's because Tina. Tina is a good friend of mine, folks, who also used to work with us here at the firm. But she still comes in, and she did all the decorating. See all the Christmas decorations she put up?
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyways, her and her husband want to garden more with me. So we're going to make it a little bit bigger so we can have more corn and more squash, as if I didn't have enough
maybe,
of either of those.
A little cactus garden or something.
Well, that's just what I'm afraid of. I just don't know if they're going to have water restrictions next year. It's just outrageous how hot and dry it is in Colorado. And do you see the December projections for Colorado? Continued hot and dry.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. But anyways...
Probably means we're going to get dumped on at some point.
You know what will happen is when I move to Kentucky and Ohio, things will switch. And all of a sudden, that area will be going through like massive droughts for the next 20 years. And Colorado will turn into some rainforest.
I don't think that's likely.
It is a dry state, folks. If you've never been to Colorado, it is dry. Anyways, this is the Q&A show. But we're going to, before we get to the Q's... Mm-hmm. We normally leave Social Security. I am going to leave with something different that I did not tell you about because I forgot.
Can't wait.
No, don't do that.
Sounds ominous.
It's not ominous. It is something that I've been waiting for, literally. And I was thinking, Chris, sooner or later, the IRS is going to say no to this, and this is going to tax court. Do you remember we did a show, because it really ticked me off? I think it was maybe 3 years ago now, which would make sense, because usually these take a couple of years to work through the legal system, on a couple of custodians of self-directed IRAs that were claiming you could have gold in an IRA and keep that gold in your own safe at home. And I sent away for some of the app, and I read through it. It just was, I was just so angry on that because I kept saying, you can't
do this.
This. Yeah. Well, guess what?
They were trying to do it, and now they're called on it.
Just came out. I got my update from Lineberg on the 23rd of November, so not too long ago at all. 2021, November 18th, 2021, the tax court issued a ruling, folks. So pay attention. We did that show, as I said, I think it was about 3 years ago. It was a while ago. In case you forget or don't quite understand, you can own gold in an IRA. Now, there are some limits on it because you cannot own collectibles in an IRA. But if you follow the rules on owning bullion, certain coins that you can own, it's okay. The IRS is copacetic with it. They don't want you owning gold jewelry or anything like that. That won't work. Or a gold-plated collectible in something. That won't work. But they do list the type of gold coins you can own. And we have no problem with people wanting to have some money in precious metals. I know some advisors have a huge issue with it. We don't. Some people really like it. And in rising inflationary environments, precious metals can be a reasonable place to find some calm from the storm, if you will, because if inflation does continue to rear its ugly head and interest rates go up, you can see bonds taking it on the chin and stocks taking it on the chin. So from that standpoint, we're fine with it. But about 3 or 4 years ago, a series of commercials came out of companies saying you can hold the gold in your own house. Hold the gold that's in your IRA yourself.
If you just own it regular outside of a retirement account, no problem. You can hold it wherever the heck you want. That's not a big deal. It's just a thing you own, like your car in the garage. We're talking about inside of an IRA.
And I said there's no way the IRS is going to allow that because there is absolutely no way. There's no custodian tracking it. Custodians who hold your IRA have to report certain things to the government. There is no way a custodian that is allegedly going to... Not only this, the custodians that set these up, folks, we're still charging the people for the damn iron. They weren't doing anything because they weren't holding the gold.
Right.
You had the gold in your own safe, allegedly. And I got one of the applications and I read through it and I just tore it a new one. And we did a whole show on it. So anyways, this guy McNulty challenged the IRS's contention that he can't own the gold outright. And it went to the tax court. I don't think it took very long. I didn't get the actual case. I listened to a summary. I subscribe to a service that sends me these reviews. So I listened to a brief summary. I have not read the case. And I don't really need to, Chris, because the gentleman who gave the summary pretty much said this. The tax court just ruled totally against McNulty on everything, ruled in favor of the IRS, and said they based their reasoning on the simple fact, without a custodian, there is no way the IRS can receive the reporting that is required, and the law requires the assets to be held by a custodian who is going to do the required reporting. And I knew they weren't going to allow this at all. So if you are listening and you did do that, or you know of someone, you do it yourself, Vanguardians, you probably don't own gold in a safe. Some of you may. But if you know of someone who does and they're telling you, they set it up as an IRA, you best warn them. McNulty versus Commissioner. And it was 157 TC. I think that stands for tax code. I don't know what the 157 is. But it came out November 18th, not too long ago. Totally blew it out of the water, Chris, which I knew they were going to do. If there's anything that can remotely look like self-dealing, they're not going to allow it. And if there's anything with an IRA that is going to give you the ability to make transactions, this is what the tax court said. You can make a transaction and the custodian will never know. Right. So they won't be able to report it.
Right.
The custodian has to act as a fiduciary. They have to be impartial, but they are required by law to report certain things to the government. They are not going, they being the government, it's not going to allow you to, oh, okay, you want to hold your own gold, so make sure if you sell it, you tell us. I mean, yeah, the government's not going to do that, but they do force a custodian to tell them, and that's what nailed this McNulty character. Anyways, just figured I would cue you in on that as well.
Okay. Right. That wasn't so ominous.
No, I didn't think so. All righty, so we're going to lead as usual on our Q&A show with a Q on Social Security. So I will let Chris do the answer, but I will do the reading. And here is someone from Michigan. So a Michigandier, I believe, is what you call it.
Some people do.
Michiganer?
I think it's Michigander.
Michigander? I was close.
Pretty close, yeah.
I don't know if I should be reading a email from Michigan, seeing as I might move to Ohio. I've become an Ohio State fan, and Michigan
didn't
have
to become a fan just because you moved there.
Well, sure you do. You gotta, like,
you're still
like
a Patriots fan, and you live in Colorado.
Well, yeah, hell,
that doesn't fit.
Well, sure it does. It's college ball. College ball, you're going to root.
You have to adopt the local.
You have to adopt the local college.
Okay.
So Michigan beat Ohio State. So I've been an Ohio State fan, folks, for about 4 weeks now. And Michigan beat us. It's terrible.
Terrible.
Apparently, I'm supposed to hate Michigan, according to all my friends in Ohio. All right. So it begins. Dear Jim, Chris, and Bob. Bobby keeps getting shout-outs. We got kudos to those of you who give shout-outs to Bob. Bob appreciates that.
He appreciates
that.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm a 65-year-old anesthesiologist.
Whoa, that just rolled off the tongue like nothing.
You like
nice
that,
job.
Huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Well, that's an easy word. I couldn't spell it.
Try it again.
Anesthesiologist.
No, very nice.
I like that.
Wow,
huh?
Yeah.
I nailed it. I won't be able to spell it, but I definitely nailed it. Okay, my wife is 60.
Mm-hmm.
We are happily married, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
And
but not pertinent to the question.
Totally not pertinent. I'll skip all that. Well, the whole beginning part of this whole email is not pertinent. Okay. My questions are, if my wife starts collecting Social Security on her own work history at 62 and switches to her spousal benefit at her full retirement age of 67, will her early collection reduce the size of her spousal benefit? And I believe what he means by that is by time she's 67, he's going to be 70 and turning his own on. So that was the first question. The second, will the amount of her spousal benefit be 50% of my benefit at my full retirement age, or will it be 50% of my benefit that I'm collecting at age 70? I know we answered both of these in the past, but it would be good to rehearse.
Very common and regularly confused. It is very confusing when there's both at play. If someone just is able to get a spousal, let's say his wife had no work history at all and only could get the spousal, it's less confusing because it's just one single component, if you will. But you have to understand how the spousal benefit is actually paid to you. Spousal benefit, first of all, grants you as a qualified spouse the ability to receive 50% of the full retirement age benefit of the other spouse. That answers his second question. The second question was, is it 50% of my PIA, my full retirement age benefit, or is it 50% of what I would be earning if I delayed to 70? The spousal benefit doesn't grow by the spouse number one, if you will, him delaying. So her maximum spousal benefit will be 50% of his full retirement age benefit, whatever benefit that is, at his full retirement age, which if he's 65 right now, that would mean he was born in 1956, so his full retirement age is 66 and 4 months if he was born in 1956. So that's the answer to the second question. The answer to the first question requires we understand how a spousal benefit is actually paid to a person. We know what the maximum amount is, half of the full retirement age benefit of, in this case, the husband. How it's paid, though, is if she didn't have a benefit at all, it's paid completely as a spousal benefit, but she has a benefit. How much isn't really important. He didn't share it, and I don't need to know the number. But the fact that she has some of her own benefit means that her overall benefit as she collects it will be two pieces, her own benefit first, and then what's called a spousal offset, or an additional amount that brings her up to that 50% of his full retirement age benefit. Now, I said the maximum she could get is 50% of his full retirement age benefit. She will only get that if she waits to her full retirement age to collect it. If she collects early, the spousal benefit is reduced. But she has a nuanced situation here. She's not claiming the spousal benefit immediately because when she's 62, he's only going to be 67 and won't have turned on his benefit yet if he's waiting till 70. So all she has access to is her own benefit. But because she's claiming it early, 62, she's going to be paid a reduced amount. Now she fast forwards to age 67, her full retirement age, or I haven't done the math. So if she's 60 now, that means her full retirement age is 67. He'll be collecting at that point because he'll be 60 or 72 by then. So he'll have been collecting for a couple of years. And she will have the right to collect 100% of the spousal benefit, which is, again, half of his full retirement age benefit. But because they pay it to her in pieces, she undermined the most she could collect by claiming her own at 62. That base amount of hers is still going to continue to be paid, and they're not going to top her up to 50% of his full retirement age benefit. They're going to award her how much she would have gotten as a spousal offset had she waited to claim both her own and the spousal at 67. So it's a little hard to follow, but just take this away from this, my cumbersome description here. If you claim either part, either component early, your benefit is reduced. So in her case, she's effectively claiming her own early, but then claiming the spousal at her full retirement age. So the one component, hers, has been reduced and will result in a reduced overall benefit for her for the rest of her life. Even though she waited to 67 to add the spousal component, they don't increase the spousal offset to make up for the fact that she claimed her own early. That reduction for her claiming her own early is a permanent reduction. The spousal offset is what it is. It's what they would have paid her had she waited to claim her own at 67 and the spousal. That's what determines the offset size, and it's fixed. Now, if she claims it her spousal early, I said by the time she's 67, he's going to be 72, she'll be eligible to get a spousal benefit the month that he claims his own benefit. So that'll be when she's 65. If she claims at 65, this isn't part of the question, I'm just embellishing. At 65, she will not only have a reduced her own benefit by claiming at 62, the spousal offset will then be reduced by a couple of years for claiming it at 65 instead of 67. So you have control depending on when you file each of these events. But it is true that if you undermine your own, if you reduce your own by claiming it early, that will have permanent effects on ultimately what you could collect as a spouse if down the road you are thinking of or eventually migrate to a spousal benefit. If you pull the trigger early on your own, that this is where people get confused a lot. They're thinking, well, I'm not collecting the spousal. I'm not turning on that part early. Well, you are, because the spousal ultimately is built out of those two pieces, your own plus the offset. Added together equals 50% of his full retirement age benefit. You can claim either of those two pieces early, and they're reduced. Delaying them doesn't help you. So you can't delay the spousal. For instance, her waiting to 70, the spousal benefit would still be capped at 50%. There's no such thing as a delayed retirement credit on the spousal benefit. So he didn't ask that question, but I thought I'd throw that in there as well. So this is kind of confusing. I'm not surprised that we get regular questions about this, but hopefully walking through, and I really just wanted to emphasize the fact that it's built out of those two pieces, and she's thinking about claiming the first piece early, 62. That will reduce the benefit forever for her.
Okay, perfect. I like it. Let's get into a couple of other questions. These next questions, they just recently came in, but I think there's kind of a time limit on them, so I'm kind of jumping them to the top of the pile. They got fairly short answers as well. So it begins, respect to you and Chris, Jim. Respect to Jim and Chris. You have my thanks for your service and the positive effect on the many people you never met or know that you have helped. I thought that was nice.
That's nice, yeah.
Okay, my question concerns a spousal inheritance of a Roth IRA. It's all going back to the five-year rule, Chris, that we've been talking about, it seems, for a while on these Roths. When the receiving spouse has no Roth herself and has to create a new Roth to receive the funds, would the new Roth receiving the inherited Roth start a new five-year period? He says, my wife and I are both 72 and we're still kicking, but you never know. So what I think he's asking and explaining is one spouse has a Roth IRA, folks. The Roth IRA is 5 years old. It's in that one spouse's name. Longtime listeners would know when one spouse dies, the other spouse can take that IRA, move it to their own as if it's theirs. But he is asking, what if that other spouse, Chris, never had a Roth? Are the earnings that would have been tax-free had the deceased spouse lived and taken them out, would the earnings be subject to taxes unless the spouse's Roth reaches 5 years? Remember, the surviving spouse mm-hmm. never had a Roth. That's what he's asking, and the answer is no. The five-year hold of the decedent's Roth will pass from spouse to spouse. So you have nothing to worry about. You don't have to run out and get a Roth in the wife's name right now. Your five-year hold of your Roth or hers of hers, whoever owns the Roth, they didn't specify, would pass to the surviving spouse, no problem.
So the full seasoning that we talked about before.
Yes, that's your new verbiage, seasoning.
Yeah, yep. Passes over to the spouse, even though they're technically opening a brand new Roth for themselves to receive these inherited spousal Roth assets, if you will. So, yeah, this is an excellent question. That question, see, I love these. Even though it was pretty straightforward, that's a brand new question. We have never had that on the show.
You don't
think so? All the years we've done this, that has never come up. I would have remembered that.
Oh, interesting. Topic. Well, thank you, listener.
That's a one-off little twist on everything we've ever talked about. That, I could swear, obviously, I can't guarantee anything. I don't have a perfect memory, but that one I don't believe has ever been brought up, even before the podcast, even on the radio. Never dealt with that one on the show.
Okay. All right, this next one, I'm jumping because I think there's a time limit if they're looking to get some things done before the end of the year, although technically they could go into next tax year as a contribution for this year. But anyways, I have it here in front of me, so I'm mm-hmm. going to jump it to the top of the list. It, too, will be a fairly straightforward answer. If my spouse and I have both maxed out our 401k contributions of $19,500 each, our Roth contributions of $6,000 each, and an HSA, could we open a SEP IRA and contribute 20% of our net earnings from a side business doing gig work? We deliver food and package delivery. Yes, but it may not be as simple as you think. you didn't give me enough information, so I'm just going to give you a little bit of advice, but you should chat with your tax person. It's all going to depend, listener, on how this side gig of you and your wife is arranged. You didn't tell me. You said you're delivering packages and food, so maybe you're working for like Uber Eats or something like that. If your wife is doing it and kind of has her own gig and you're doing yours and you have your own gig, then both of you absolutely could. Let's just say, Chris, they grossed $10,000 and their expenses were $2,000, okay? Just making these numbers up, he didn't give me any numbers. So your net earnings would be $8,000. If you have your own business, truly your own, listener, and your wife or husband, again, I don't know who wrote this email, has his or her own, and it's the same as I described, $10,000 gross, $2,000 of expenses, $8,000 net, each of you can contribute 20% of your net earnings. It's approximately 20%. There's calculations.
Yeah, it's actually a funky calculation.
Yeah, it's a funky calculation. That's what I was ready to say. There are websites and calculators or CPAs that will do it for you. But a good rule of thumb is about 20% of net earnings. So that would be about $1,600 for each of them. Mm-hmm. Now, if you own it as a partnership, things might get a little bit hairy. And I would encourage you to talk to a tax person because it's going to depend. And I wish I had the, I had printed out and I didn't bring it with me. This is why I don't like doing this without prepping like I like to do, but to keep you happy. Okay, I did find it. Good. Excellent. What you have to understand is a husband and wife, and I'm not a tax expert and Bob's not on the show today, but a husband and wife may be able to be a qualified joint venture. And if you are, if you and your spouse are the sole partners in a partnership, you may be considered a qualified joint venture if, and I'm getting this from the Small Business Hub Business Tax Law website. So I had to go digging for this because I remembered about qualified ventures, but I couldn't remember it, so I had Googled it. So Google that too, listener, and you can see if you qualify. But in short, and I'm getting this directly from their website, so if it's wrong, you can blame them. You and your spouse are the only partners. You file a joint personal tax return, and you both materially participate. This is a hard word. Materially participate in the partnership. If all three of those are met, you may be a qualified joint venture. And that gives you, and again, I'm not a tax expert, but it gives you some special tax rules where the $8,000 net might be on each side of their ledger separately, and I'm not sure, but they might be able to contribute off of that. So that's why I got a hold of the Ed Slot group on this to ask them, and they said the same thing. You don't have enough info of that listener to give them direct advice. They encourage you to find out if you do qualify as a joint venture. And then if you do, if you have those elements that I just described, talk to a CPA, talk to your tax person about, you can put money into a SEP. The question is how much and how is it going to be determined if you qualify. The other thing I want to mention is if one of you own the business and the other is kind of an employee, then things are a little different. Let's say the husband, Chris, owns the business, right? Mm-hmm. Grosses $10,000, has $2,000 of expenses, nets $8,000. Okay? We know the husband can put in his SEP approximately 20% of $8,000 or $1,600. Mm-hmm. But let's say the $2,000 of expenses, $1,500 was salary to his wife, $500 was gas to do all the delivery. So his wife earned $1,500.
Right.
She can put in the same percentage amount, which is 25% of her salary. Now, you may be saying, I thought it was 20. It's 25%, but for a self-employed person, it's 20% of...
Effectively.
Right. When you do the calculation, that's where the 20% of net earnings come from. You're actually putting in 25%, but it's the way you adjust for self-employment taxes that screw it all up. So that's why we say as a rule of thumb, it's 20% of net earnings. But the employee can put 25% in, or 375
of their earnings.
Yeah. Correct. So I don't know. You didn't give me enough info, listener. Is one spouse the owner? The other's an employee? Are you both joint owners and qualify as a joint venture? Then you got to talk to a CPA to truly figure out how much each of you can put in? Or is one the owner, one the employee? That if so, one can put in a lot and the other can put in a little. You will be able to contribute, which is, I think, what they were asking. We maxed everything out. Can we still do a SEP? Yes. How much? I don't know. You got to do some digging. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever had that question before.
No, I don't. I think this is a wonderful day.
all
fresh and new.
Fresh and new questions. Yes, I like that. See what you get. All right. This next one, I don't know if we talked about this before. We may have. Okay, so he begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I am George," puts his name in quotation marks, so I'm assuming he's protecting his anonymity. "I am George from Texas," so he'd be a Texan. Mm-hmm. "I was reading an article recently about Roth conversions, and something caught my attention." And he gives us a direct quote from the Kiplinger's article that he was reading. "This client had heard," and this is the quote, this isn't the email. "This client had heard about Roth conversions and about a year ago asked me," it was an advisor who wrote this obviously, "asked me about doing one. When I reviewed his tax returns, though, I discovered something interesting. He is retired and receiving disability that is not taxable. In fact, he could take money out of his traditional IRA each year and still not owe taxes. Since his major source of income is tax-free, he was not a good candidate for a Roth conversion." When I read that, I had a bigger question.
What?
Who the hell is going to tell their client, because you have tax-free income, you shouldn't be converting? Oh, my God. So we can run into that in a minute.
Yeah. Well,
let's get, yeah, before we rip that, because I knew you were going to, because I did the same thing. I read this twice. I thought it was the emailer asking me the question until I realized, no, this was a snippet of an advisor answering a question. And I nearly, you know what, when I read that. We'll get back to that in a second. So the reader says, "I was surprised by that. Disability pay is not subject to income tax? Is this correct?" So before we rip the actual answer that got your attention, let's address that. Yes, it depends who pays the premium. If your employer pays the premium for your disability insurance, it will be taxable to you. If you pay the premium, it will be tax-free. If both of you paid the premium, which is very common, if both of you paid the premium, only the portion of the disability payment attributable to what the employer pays, so if he paid 40% and you paid 60, 40% would be taxable. Mm-hmm. Now, there are certain occupations or careers such as military and first responder. I was injured on duty as a police officer for almost a year and a half due to injury on my knee that I suffered. I won't get into all that. But while I was out on disability, they called it IOD, injured on duty. When I was out on IOD, Chris, my pay was only 60% of my salary. But excuse me, being injured, it's 100%. I apologize. It was 100% of my salary, and it was tax-free. So certain occupations also will get tax-free disability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some military pensions are partially or totally tax-free because of that same issue if they had a disability or injury while on deployment and things. There's certain special rules there as well that are, I'm not an expert in that area, but I've definitely seen that.
Now let's get back in to the paragraph I just read, folks, because I nearly fell off my chair when I read that. I don't know the whole question, but let's just take this two sentences at face value. So it's an advisor answering a question, obviously. And he's saying again, this client had heard about Roth conversions and about a year ago asked me about doing one. So that's why it leads me to believe it's an advisor writing this, Chris. Mm-hmm. When I reviewed his tax returns, though, I discovered something interesting. He is retired on disability that is not taxable. In fact, he could not take money out of his traditional IRA each year. And this is what is, I read it wrong. In fact, he could take money out of his traditional IRA each year and still not owe any taxes. Since his major source of income is tax-free, he was not a good candidate for a Roth conversion. This made me cringe because as I read this, now but it could be a lot more to the story, I'm thinking, is this disability income going to last forever?
Probably not.
Correct. And at some point, he's got taxable income again? I don't know. Does he have children who might be in a much higher tax bracket? And if he's in a position to start converting assets now at essentially very low or negligible brackets, like fill the 12% bracket while it still exists, taking money out of an IRA, folks, is not going to impact the taxability of your disability. It is impacted by the career you were in and in the military, what caused your disability or who paid the premiums. It's not, well, if you take money out of your IRA, we're going to tax your disability. That has nothing to do with it. And the taxation, Chris, of a withdrawal from an IRA or a conversion of IRA is the same.
Right. So he, on one hand, they're saying you could take money out as a distribution without paying tax.
Which is good.
Without without recognizing you could convert without paying any tax and then put it in an account where all future growth is tax free. My gosh, this, you know, there definitely needs to be a tax projection. This tax situation is unlikely to remain throughout this person's life. This is most likely a temporary situation that when he comes off of disability, which is going to be at what is usually called normal retirement age, which for the most part is going to be somewhere in your 60s, depending on how the disability, you know, we don't have any description of where this, what the source of the disability payment is, but that's going to stop at some point because they don't keep paying you disability when you would have been retired anyway. It's not how it works. So that's going to stop. And then he's going to have other sources. They're going to say, well, we're going to stop paying you disability, but you're now old enough to claim Social Security. Well, Social Security isn't tax-free, right? If you have any other significant sources of income. So there better be somebody looking out for this person, looking down the road, realizing there's going to be bigger taxes. Why not take advantage of this sweet opportunity right now to do some tax planning and some tax deployment or tax strategies? My gosh, that blanket statement of, oh, doesn't seem to be a good candidate for Roth conversion, seems opposite what this situation, this is screaming, consider a Roth conversion to me.
I agree. It's when I saw that, it's the language that was in there. Not a good candidate because you have no income, essentially.
That's the perfect time to be doing conversions.
Absolutely. So anyways, I wanted to explain a little bit of that to this listener. And maybe one of these days I'll try to dig up that Kiplinger article and try to get the whole context.
And we don't know the whole story, so maybe there's some other element that we're not aware of that makes more sense.
He gave me the link. Let me make sure he actually gave me the link. I have it on paper, as you know, so I can't click it. It looks like a live link. Let me go back and dig up that email and click that link and try to get the whole context, folks, of that question. And then we'll go back. Maybe that'll make for a good...
On the next show, if there's something more to this story that makes sense, maybe we'll bring it back up.
Right.
But having low levels of taxable income, or in this case, zero taxable income, talk about a tax planning window opportunity. It's a beautiful time to be really considering some conversions to try to avoid future higher taxes. Now, if through the projection somehow this person's never expected to pay taxes for the rest of their life, that'd be weird, but that would be not a good candidate for doing Roth conversions. But, you know, you mentioned kids, even though your tax situation might be like that forever for your anticipated life expectancy, you may, if you're not going to consume all your assets, you might be leaving a tax time bomb for kids. So yeah, all the stuff needs to be considered before just ignoring an opportunity like this.
Right. Okay. Here is another straightforward question. This is from someone who gives his real name, but we're going to call him George. He actually puts George in parentheses, so he must be a longtime listener. George is from the, as he put it, Chris, hot and humid state of, want to take a guess?
Hot and humid, Ohio.
Indiana.
Okay, close.
Indiana. Yeah. Indiana. It was that day when I was driving across country in July and got out in Indiana, oh, nearly knocked me on my hiney. It was humid. All right. It says, Jim, I can't wait for each new episode of the podcast. I think everyone should follow your minimum dignity floor way of thinking. Thinking. I know it's a good idea to do a Roth conversion when the market is down. But what do you think about converting when the market is up? What is your take on this? Thanks for all you and Chris do. A conversion is a conversion is a conversion. If your numbers show, if you've done a tax projection and it says you should convert $30,000 before the end of the year, remember, folks, a Roth conversion must be done in the calendar year you want to do it, because you can no longer, well, you obviously, all the time, you could never. What confuses people, Chris, contributions can be done up to the tax filing of the following year. So you have till April 15th of 2022 to make a contribution for 2021. But a conversion must be done in the tax year. So that's always been the rule. What he's getting at or asking, should he convert only if the market is down? And what he's assuming is the market will recover, which it will, and all that recovery will be tax-free. And remember, folks, you don't have to convert cash. That would be one of the biggest mistakes. Let's say you had an investment in a regular IRA, Chris, of $60,000, okay? And it dropped to $30,000. Do you still have the same number of shares you had at 60?
You do. They're just each worth less.
Correct. So let's just say you had, I don't know, 1,000 shares and the stock was trading or the mutual fund was trading or the ETF was trading at $60 a share, folks. So you got $60,000. Now it drops by half. You still got the same 1,000 shares. So when you do a conversion, you can convert shares, not dollars. So you convert the 1,000 shares or $30,000. Now, he's saying it's great to convert when the market is down. I agree. If you're still holding those 1,000 shares and you feel comfortable they're going to come back, because all that recovery, Chris, would be tax-free. But he's asking, what about the opposite? What if you still have a $60,000 balance, 1,000 shares, you want to convert $30,000, so now you're only going to be able to convert 500 shares, Chris, right? Not 1,000.
Right.
He says, is that a good idea? If the tax person is saying to convert and convert that tax year and you're running out of time because it's got to be done by the end of this year on a conversion, you got no choice whether the timing is pro or con. You can choose to vote against all the politicians who voted not too long ago to remove what, Chris? Recharacterizations. Thank you.
I was about to say that.
I'm sure. Recharacterizations were the get out of jail free card for what this man is worried about. He's worried about the market dropping. He converts the $60,000, only 500 shares, converts $30,000 rather, folks. So he's got $30,000 in a Roth and $30,000 in a traditional IRA, 500 shares in each. And then what happens, Chris? Then the 50% correction happens.
Right.
And now he's got $1,500 in each account. Same dollar amounts as my original explanation. But because he already did the conversion, he's stuck owing taxes on $30,000 that is now only worth $15,000. From a tax standpoint, he has optimized his tax bracket, which is what he was doing the conversion on, I'm guessing, in this situation. But from a emotional standpoint, he's left feeling jilted because he owes taxes on $30,000 and it's now only worth $15,000. And if he would have waited X amount of months before doing the conversion, he wouldn't have had to have done that. That's just the cost of doing conversions because of the politicians who voted to undo or remove, rather, recharacterizations. And what irked me the most on that, Chris, they called it a loophole.
Right.
They wrote it, and I kept saying, it's not a loophole. It was in the damn law. You were following the law. The law said you can recharacterize. But they said it was a loophole and only a giveaway to who?
The rich. Yeah.
They never defined who the damn rich were in that case. It was a loophole used by the rich. BS. It was a planning strategy used by everybody. And the government realized this is costing us money. Why? Because when the market's correct, people were undoing the conversion, filing a amended return, and getting money back on their taxes. Because you had until October 15th of the year following the year of conversion. It gave you a lot of time to undo this. Remove a lot of that market uncertainty. Now it's not there. So yeah. My answer to him is, if it makes sense from a tax standpoint, do it. Don't let the tax dog wag its tail. But what you want to do, if the market is up, recognize you're going to be exposed to the risk that the market drops, and emotionally you may have paid more in taxes than you should have. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's hard, first of all, there's a market timing element here. What I wouldn't want people to do is not optimize their tax situation, hoping for a market drop when then they could do a conversion later. What you're doing there, though, is you are hoping for something that may or may not happen while absolutely giving up a year's worth of a certain tax bracket. So I like to look at it in that context, that there has been identified a pretty clear advantage to filling up a certain amount of taxable income in a given year. Don't give that up for the hopes that there's going to be some kind of market timing event that you can take advantage of down the road. Look at market timing, like if there happens to be also a drop in a year that you're going to, you know, do things, or something just gets a gift gets dropped in your lap in a market decline where you don't need the money now for a while, so you can wait but convert while it's down so that the rebound is tax free. That's just icing on the cake, if you will. That's an extra bonus, but shouldn't be the ultimate driving force or the goal that you're targeting, because that timing, we don't know. That timing is so elusive. Think of it as, if it happens, react to it, but don't make it part of the forecasted plan, because there's no way you can forecast that well enough. It control what you can control given the information that you have, and make the best decisions possible, but don't avoid things because of a hopeful situation that may or may not happen, I guess would be the way I pointed out. And yes, listeners, I did hear him say, don't let the tax dog wag its tail. We all know what he means.
What?
You don't let the tax tail wag the dog.
That's, I always say that.
I know, but you said the tax dog wagging its tail.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure.
No, I always say the tax tail wag the dog.
I know, and we all know what you meant. But I feel if I don't say something, people will think that I didn't notice.
You don't have to point things like, you. I know we don't edit, but you could have edited it.
I could have.
Could you edit that out, too?
I could have edited that out, too. We're not gonna.
Damn you.
No, everyone knew. I'm
so why do you mention it if everyone knows?
Because they thought that I didn't notice it, because they're used to me pointing it out. I pay attention to what he says.
Well, thank you for letting me go, because I was on a roll there.
Yeah, I know. I didn't want to interrupt right there. I like to interrupt sometimes, but that one I let you go because you were like just laying it out.
I was on it. Yes, yeah. I was rocking it. How much more time do we have?
We have a little more time.
Coolio. This one could easily be a short answer, or I could turn this into a 14-hour answer, but I think we'll err on the side of short. Hi, Jim and Chris. My mother-in-law has a... Where is he from? I like to begin with that. I won't even pronounce where he is, but he's in California. Temecula?
Temecula. Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
All right, I nailed it. Cool. Temecula. He calls it beautiful wine country.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been there?
Not in a long time, and only driven through. Didn't really spend time there.
Okay. Well, he gives his real name, but he says, a.k.a., also known as... George.
George, yeah.
Okay, from Temecula, California. Hi, Jim and Chris. My mother-in-law has her trust listed as her traditional IRA beneficiary. Mm-hmm. I believe the trust names both my wife and my brother-in-law to receive everything 50-50. So, brother and sister each going to get it 50-50. Very mm-hmm. typical situation with a parent mm-hmm. with two children.
Mm-hmm.
But is it going to be better for her to just name both children 50-50 on her beneficiary form of her IRA for tax purposes? She has $3 million in her IRA.
Hmm. Yeah, this is one where people who've been listening for a while, and probably why he wrote in, know that we're not fans of naming a trust as beneficiary of an IRA unless there's a clear, justifiable reason for doing so. Could it work fine in this case? It could. But why run the risk? There's so much opportunity or threat that having the trust in the middle is going to muck things up and cause an undesirable outcome. For the kids, for the brother and sister in this particular case.
Right.
That why run the risk unless there's a clearly identified reason and the trust is designed properly to try to avoid bad effects, if you will. So the question I would ask, and the person who set this up, what is the clearly defined reason for doing it this way? If that cannot be identified, they should be named directly as beneficiaries, in my opinion.
Right. I was going to say the same thing with a little more depth. And that is, why? What's the purpose of the trust? He doesn't give us enough information.
Right. And there might be a good reason.
Exactly. He doesn't say my spendthrift wife mm-hmm. and special needs brother. I mean, I'm being facetious there, but if there is a reason that the mother is using a trust, maybe the wife is a spendthrift, maybe the brother is on special needs and she needs to protect both of them for various reasons. A trust should be used for protection and control. We recently got an email that we're going to answer shortly. I may do it as an EDU, where someone talks about using a trust for tax purposes. We'll get into that. But for the most part, a trust is used for protection and control. So if the mother needs to protect and or control that $3 million IRA for a certain reason and not give it to your wife, her $1.5 million outright, and her brother $1.5 million outright, as Chris just said, maybe the trust will work perfectly.
But there will be a cost.
There's a definite cost. But if the mother simply went to an attorney who said, I'm going to make this real simple. We're going to leave everything to the trust, and the trust is going to give everything to the kids 50-50. So assign everything to your trust at your death, or something to that effect that some attorneys say. And she simply said, oh, this is going to be great. So she names primary beneficiary on her IRA, my trust. And the trust may be set up to give everything 50-50, but that would be one of the worst things. Mm-hmm. If she's not looking to protect and or control that IRA, you are correct, listener. Give it to the kids outright. It's the quickest. It's the easiest. Mm-hmm. If it's not protection and control, and it's just because some attorney said it's going to make her life easier, and I am not throwing attorneys under the bus. Everybody throws them under the bus until you need one. I've been working with an attorney this year as part of our restructuring, Chris, for the firm. Mm-hmm. You know, the caterpillar turning it into the butterfly type thing, why we paused.
Mm-hmm.
He's been worth his weight in gold. He better will be the hourly fee he's charging me. But goodness, he's like a walking encyclopedia of SEC law. It's great. So yeah, everybody wants, we can make fun of attorneys, but they can be great when we need them. But I've also met some attorneys, Chris, that I wouldn't trust their advice with a 10-foot pole. So maybe this attorney might have given some irrational advice to you, the stepmom?
Or maybe wasn't clear in the instructions, and she did this on her own. And maybe just simply asked, well, could I do this? And he didn't, you know, give the long answer and said, well, you can. Yeah, you can do that if you want to. And
I was left ready it at to that. Say that. I was ready to protect attorneys. Yeah. I'm not throwing them under the bus. It could be that the mother-in-law misunderstood. Because here's what can happen. If it's not for protection and control, and it's going to go to the trust, unless that trust is specifically set up to be an IRA trust, and it doesn't sound to me like it is, and even then you would use sub-trusts. A good attorney would use sub-trusts, a sub-trust for the wife, his wife, and a sub-trust for the brother, Chris, and the sub-trusts would be named on the IRA beneficiary form, not the master trust. He's making it sound like she has a trust, and the trust is on the IRA. So it's telling me there's no sub-trust here. The sub-trust would allow each person, his wife and the brother of his wife, to have their own trusts with their own IRA paying into it. So they can manage it and do what they want on their own for the 10-year period that inherited IRA can stay open. Remember, under the Secure Act, it's now a 10-year payout for non-spouse beneficiaries, Chris. But what I fear is this. For one reason or another, that trust is not set up that way, and it wasn't the intent of the attorney to set it up that way. And it's just a simple trust that says, all my assets go into this trust, my debts for the estate are paid, and everything remaining is divided 50-50. That's my fear. And if that's it, you're going to run into some huge issues. Least of which is, now I know Chris spoke of this recently and you got it from the Ed Slot page, but there's just been another PLR. Leanberg is perfect. If you're an advisor, subscribe to Leanberg because you get all these great email updates. Several more PLRs have recently come out again, Chris, with people having to ask the IRS, can we take this trust that received the money here, I'm the only beneficiary, or we are the only beneficiaries, and we're the trustees. We want to spread that IRA out into our own inherited IRAs. Can we do that? And the IRS always says, what, Chris? Yes. But it takes what? A $10,000 PLR fee.
Right.
What I'm getting at, if it's set up that way, your wife is not going to have her own $1.5 million inherited IRA that she has up to 10 years to empty, and the brother isn't going to have his $1.5 million IRA. In the eyes of the IRS, the beneficiary is the trust.
Right.
The trust, if it's not set up properly, may not be it's definitely not going to be a human. And you're going to run into a whole host of issues. We've gone over these issues 9 times to Sunday on previous shows. I would begin this conversation, listener, not with telling your mother-in-law she did it wrong, or maybe having your wife bridge with what Chris said at first. Why? Right. What is it you're trying to do, Mom? Let us know. Well, here's what I want to do. I want to protect and control. If you hear that come from her, I want to protect this IRA, or I want to help control. I don't want you to spend it too fast. If it's protection and control, pat her on the back and say, okay. And then hope the attorney set everything up correctly.
Well, and hopefully someone will point out the cost of that protection and control, because there might be significant cost to
tax
it. And once she realizes the cost, she might say, oh, it's not worth that to get the kind of protection I'm talking about. I'm a little worried about protection, so I thought it was a good idea. But if we're going to lose half of it in taxes, I don't want to. I'm not that worried about protection. So make sure you know that she understands the whole story and the trade-offs before just letting it go.
And if, for those of you who don't understand what Chris means, could lose up to half in taxes, go listen to the other shows. Because an IRA paying into a trust set up for protection and control will be nailed. Absolutely nailed with federal and state income taxes.
Yep.
Absolutely nailed. So go back and listen to the other shows. But he does say something unique in this. Is it better for her to just name both kids 50-50 on a beneficiary form for tax purposes? When I read that, I thought, maybe it is a discretionary trust for protection and control that's going to hold those assets that are going to get nailed in taxes. Mm-hmm. So yes, it would be better to pass them to the children from a tax perspective, but that might not be what the mom wants.
Right.
So it's the mom's money. She has a right to make up her mind. You need to begin the conversation with why. When you ask from a tax perspective, would it be better to name the children outright? Yes. But if the mom is truly looking to protect and control it, my answer is no. It's up to the mom to decide. If her answer is, I was just trying to make it easy, she's making it harder
right.
and more complex. All other assets, get her to understand. Mom, you see $3 million of assets. Let's say she's a Vanguardian. Mom, you see $3 million worth of ETFs and mutual funds at Vanguard. You see assets. What is the IRS going to see, Chris?
Income.
Income. Why is that?
Well, because it's, think of it as deferred income. You've deferred income while you earned it, putting it in these retirement accounts. Grows in there. As it comes out, it all gets recognized as income. So it's income that's just been waiting there. They call it specifically income with respect to a decedent, so IRD. But without getting using fancy words, it's just, it went in there without being recognized as income when you first put it in there. So it's sitting there as one big ball of income waiting to be recognized. And as it comes out, that's what it is.
Right. So you got to tell her that, Ma, you see assets, the IRS is going to see income. And then that income is going to pay into the trust. And it's just going to be a hassle. If the trust holds it, it's going to be taxed. If you pass it on, each child is not going to be able to have their own inherited IRA without applying for a private letter ruling. Now, Chris, you just said recently, and you got this from the slot question, there are some custodians. Do you remember which custodians?
They said all the major custodians were allowing this to happen.
See, in the rules are, folks, you're not allowed. If a trust is beneficiary of an IRA, you're not allowed to just break it into small inherited IRAs for the beneficiaries of the trust. You usually have to get a PLR. Now, the rules are quite explicit on those PLRs. That's why I'm surprised some PLRs are working, because the IRS wants to make sure of two things. The beneficiaries have unfettered access to the money. There's no protection and control in it. It's just money passes in and automatically goes out. And they're generally the trustee of the trust as well. So they control it. They can have get it with no restriction. The IRS says, yeah, we'll just let it pass through to its own inherited IRA. But you need a PLR to do that. That's why I guess they've always ruled yes on these PLRs, always, as long as the trust meets these minimums I just described. So maybe there are some custodians that are saying, to heck with it, we know it's going to be yes, we'll honor
it. We're not worried about getting questioned on this, so we'll go ahead and do it.
But not all custodians will do that, listener. Right. And let your mom know it's $10,000 to apply for a PLR plus the legal fees of the attorney, or the, mostly we use a tax attorney or a very qualified CPA, to put the argument together. You just don't ask the question to the IRS. You got to lay out why you think you should be allowed to do this. So someone has to go research based on this PLR and that PLR and this tax code and that. We feel this, and this is what we're asking for. So you're creating all of that. Get her to understand that. Every one of you who are using a trust, just if you cannot say this is for protection and control, I wouldn't use a trust as beneficiary of an IRA. And because it is income, if she is using it for protection and control, that means that trust is going to hold the IRA money and not pass it through. And if it's holding income, it is going to get nailed in taxes, and the IRA is 100% income. That, Chris is correct, close to 50% will be lost the minute it is put into the trust, unless that trust passes it out, which it wouldn't because it's for protection and control.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
very common. Run into this all the time.
We get these questions a lot. I, again, not a fan of trusts as beneficiaries of an IRA, but not against them. It's just got to be in the right situation.
Right. Well, with that, we'll have to wrap up the show for today. Thanks. A good slew of questions. I like when we have brand new ones, so that was very exciting. Anything else you want to say in wrapping things up?
I don't think so. Oh, I do want to make mention of one thing, because some people have emailed me personally. They hear on the show that we have put a pause on, which we have. Chris and I have paused accepting new retirement planning clients and, by default, tax planning clients, because we need the data from the retirement plan to do the tax plan. Obviously, we've mentioned many a times we are still open for our asset management, our tax preparation, and our insurance services. I want to encourage people, though, as we pause, we're pausing because we are changing our business model, and it's just going to be easier for us for the next year to pause. So when we emerge, we'll explain to you our new model, what we're doing, and I think I use the analogy of a caterpillar, which is what our business is now, going to emerge as a butterfly. But that said, I do want to encourage people, if you are interested in working with us, send an email to admin@jimhelps.com. That will actually go to Chris's daughter, Mayanna. She's keeping a list of any people who want to be contacted when we are going to reopen. So if you get on that list or unpause, I hate to say reopen, Chris, because it makes it sound like we're closed.
Right.
We're still here. We're still taking care of our existing clients. We still have people in our planning queue that we will be working on all of next year. Nothing has changed. We're just not adding new people until we can get our new business model up and running. Mayanna would be happy to put you on that list because she's going to reach out to those people first, Chris, when we're ready to unpause, to let them know before we announce it to the quote-unquote general public, I guess you could say, before we start using it in our advertising and taking on referrals, which is mostly how we grow our practice. So before we start doing any of that, we will announce or reach out to those of you who wanted to try to talk to us but can't because we have this pause. So she asked me to make mention of that, so I'm making mention of that.
Yeah, perfect. So that's admin@jimhelps.com would be where to send that. So thanks for sharing that, and that ring must mean you're wanted to go start your weekend.
No, that's mom calling me for something. I'm not sure what.
Okay. So we want to thank everybody for listening again this week. We really appreciate it. We've had a great year. We're heading into December here. We're in the home stretch of 2021. So,
and remember, though, folks, also, this is more of a planning thing because we're doing it in our office. Make sure you're starting to check, especially with all the volatility in the market and some bond holdings that might be negative for the year. Start to see if there's any tax loss opportunities that you can take advantage of. Start doing a little bit of tax planning. Look at your spending coming for next year. Try to see, should you take some extra IRA money out this year to be used next year because your tax situation this year is lower than it's going to be next year? Mm-hmm. These are things that you should be looking. We're looking at it now with all our people. It's a busy time of year for us. So make sure you're looking at all these things. Should you be taking money out of your IRA now to use for next year? If you take it out now, taxes are this year. Or the other way, Chris, maybe if you needed some money this year, you come up with it another way and take it out in 3 weeks when it's taxed next year.
Mm-hmm.
So start doing some year-end tax planning. Start looking at these elements. Don't let them go to waste. If you want to convert, get it done before the end of the year. You can't recharacterize. If you have after-tax basis in your IRA or 401k, you've got only a few more weeks, I think, for you to be able to
convert
it.
Probably a few more days to start it because there's going to be a crush of people trying to do it later this month. So don't think you have weeks to do this. You need to be starting to do that right away.
Get it done. We've warned you on that. Custodians, TD Ameritrade has told us December 3rd, Get everything into them by December 3rd if you want to make sure it's done by the end of the month.
That's today.
They're not saying that they still can't get it done if you got it into them the 6th, 10th, 8th. But they're saying if you want to make sure December 3rd was their deadline.
Yeah.
They get swamped in December.
Yep.
So start doing some tax planning. Start looking at losses, especially on your bond holdings. See if it makes sense to realize any of them and purchase them again in 31 days or a get rid of a short-term bond, maybe buy an intermediate-term bond to avoid the wash sale rule or something. Start looking at these tax planning opportunities before December passes you by. December goes by so fast. It's like the fastest state in the world. Fastest month in the world. That's what I meant to say. I was testing Chris. But December flies by. I don't know why. It just does. And then January drags. January is like, takes forever. It's just, and they're both 30-something days, like 30 or 31 days. It's just nuts. December flies by. January drags by. Get this done while you still have time.
Perfect. Well, thanks a lot. You have a good weekend, and everyone else is listening. Hope you do as well. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.